I'm actually fighting with a fly in my Marco will hear the fly later. I'm distracted by trying to track down and kill this fly. I'll get it eventually. I feel like we have to take a break from the show for me to hunt it down. But anyway.
Do you want me to lend you an iPad too?
I've forgotten about that. Oh no, my God, that's not old school. Oh my goodness.
Talk amongst yourselves for a moment. I will kill or shoo this fly out of the room. It needs to be done. Hang on. This fly did not want to leave, did not want to die.
How did you convince it? Did you argue with it until it realized it was wrong?
I would have killed it if I could have caught it, but it wouldn't land. And I was trying to get it to leave the room, so I was turning off the lights in this room and turning on bright lights elsewhere to try to lure it out.
If you want, we can start talking about destiny. It'll leave immediately.
Truth.
Just bore it out of the room.
No, the flies love destiny.
So a friend of the show, Dave Nanian, wrote in, and he has opinions about universal remotes and things of that nature.
Of super duper fame, Dave Nanian.
Yep,
that's wonderful, right. Backup application that you should use, or equivalent, to make multiple backups of your stuff. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, he's not talking about universal remotes. I'm sorry, he's talking about CEC.
Yeah, he has very often been the proponent of the spend a lot of money to solve your electronics problem. solution, which is one possible solution. I've never been particularly a fan of it because I feel like
I'm shocked.
No matter how, not because I don't want to spend a lot of money on things. I have a really expensive TV, but I feel like no matter how much money you spend, it will still never work right, and you'll feel worse if you spent a lot more money. But anyway, he's happy with his setup. He has Bang & Olufsen stuff, and he has a Bang & Olufsen TV, which itself acts as like the hub for everything. It's like six HDMI inputs and built-in sound system that you can connect like 18 speakers to the TV, and it does wireless stuff, and it integrates with like home control systems. You can raise and lower your blinds and turn on your lights and security cameras, like all the rich people stuff that you would imagine. And because the TV itself is the hub for all of this stuff, you don't have a situation like Casey described last time of the universal remote having to track the state of all your devices. And if it gets out of sync, then it's very confused. The TV knows the state of everything because it is the hub for everything. And it can, you know, sense when it's getting input on the different things, and the speakers are hooked up directly to the television. So it takes out a lot of the guesswork. And they have all these fancy pants things where you can take all of your equipment that's big and noisy and put it in the basement and connect it with a big Ethernet cable up to your system upstairs. You can hide all the stuff, things that you would spend thousands and thousands of dollars for. Of course, the downside of this is, you have to, at the very least, have this big fancy Bang & Olufsen TV and some other proprietary components that go with it. And Bang & Olufsen doesn't really make good TVs. This is a problem, right? The television that I have, at the time that I bought it, had I bought a fancy Bang & Olufsen thing, I would be getting a worse television set in terms of picture quality in exchange for all this other stuff. So I'm still stuck because of my priorities. Buying individual components and slapping them together and trying to make do with it. But if you're willing to compromise on not having the absolute very best of every individual component, you can buy an integrated solution for a tremendous amount of money that I don't think is worth it, but you'll be happy. And another solution, I was asking a while back on Twitter, the best solution for, we talked about this in the show, for me to get the video off of my Blu-rays without recompressing it, just preserve it exactly bit for bit the way it is on my Blu-rays and then play it back in my television without having a spinning plastic disc.
That's Make MKV, isn't it? That'll do.
No. Yeah, but remember, my issue was playback. I can't get 24 frames per second cadence playback out of any of my boxes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we talked about that on a past show, which none of us will be remembering in the show notes. But anyway, one of the rich person solutions to that is those boxes they sell that I think is technically legal because someone paid a lot of money to the Blu-ray Association, where you buy the super expensive box and you feed it either all of your Blu-rays in a big jukebox or one at a time. And it basically rips your Blu-rays for you losslessly and lets you play them back. But it does it in a way that like complies with the letter of the law. I don't know, whatever. It's not a pirate thing. It's an entirely legal thing, but it's tremendously expensive. And it's just, it's like outside the amount of money I'm willing to pay for that. I will just stick the disc in the DVD, in the Blu-ray player and deal with the spinning disc noise at this point. But hopefully we'll get there eventually. We're close. Like I said, we're really close. The only barrier remaining is me not having a way to play that content back on my television, preserving the correct, frame rate and everything without doing a spinning disc.
I should point out that I have achieved 80% of this I also would have the same problem with 24 frames a second, but I don't care because I don't think I have anything of that rate, and I usually watch TV shows. But I ripped the entire Wire Blu-ray set, and it was very, very easy with modern tools because all I had to do was use Make MKV to rip the Blu-ray and then Subler to basically rewrap it in an MP4 container without having to transcode the video. Although I believe I had to transcode the audio because I don't care about surround sound. Please email John.
And you've modified it already.
Yeah, well, who cares? But that's optional. You could have left the giant like AC3 and DTS tracks on there if you really wanted to. But I don't even have surround speakers anymore because I decided years ago they weren't worth the hassle. So anyway, so I was able to rip the entire TV series with Subler and Make MKV in surprisingly little time. And just like this roughly $100 USB 3 Blu-ray drive that I had in the closet from a little while back, and yeah, it works great. And now I play them in Plex, and it's so it has all the metadata from Plex somehow magically through some probably not quite legal service, and it's great. I absolutely love it, and it's way faster and more reliable and way better quality than the HBO Go now. Mini app, whatever it is, the HBO Mini app on TV, it's way better than that. Way better quality, no dropping frames issues. So it wasn't a problem with like the bitrate or anything. It was a problem with HBO sucking. And yeah, overall, a great solution to watch any kind of HBO show is buy the Blu-rays and rip them all. It actually works surprisingly well.
So that's what I do with the content I don't actually care about. The ones I care about, I need it to be the highest possible quality. So yeah, I have tons of stuff in Plex. I have tons of things that are, but for the things I care about, I want the very best quality, and that's still putting the disc in the little drive.
But wait a minute, though. So the only limitation of what I was just saying is possibly audio. Does if the Apple TV can output whatever DTS or whatever over the optical port, then you wouldn't have any quality problems, right?
It's not an optical port. You can do it over HDMI if it's smart enough. A lot of the applications won't send the unmodified audio. Like, they won't send the DTS HD stream directly to my receiver. They just won't do it.
Yeah, but I bet Plex would, or there's probably an option.
Plex and Infuse, it depends on which one is in the best mood, or like the DS video app. I have many options to do it. But really, it's the video, because the most of the content I really care about, I'm mostly talking about movies, and they're 24 frames per second, and it's a deal breaker. I can't get that to my TV any other way.
Yeah, and that's mainly a hardware issue, right? That you don't have any TV boxes that run software that could play movies and would output the right signal?
It's not hardware, it's software. Like, Apple TV could be changed in such a way to output 24 frames per second cadence video. Is my, my PlayStation 3 can output that. That's what I put the Blu-ray into, right? I've even tried putting the video files on the PlayStation 3 and having it do it, but I can't get that to work either. So the only time my PlayStation 3 outputs in this way is when it's playing a Blu-ray. The Apple TV is always locked at, 60 frames per second or whatever it's outputting at, and it just we went through this in the past.
Yeah.
But I have nothing that can do it. And there's no technical reason. It's not like these things aren't powerful enough or whatever. A lot of people have newer televisions than mine that can do the detecting the cadence and accounting for it and everything. But I've run all the video tests, and it just nothing can get 24 frames per second out there except for my Blu-ray player. So that's what I keep using. My next setup, hopefully, we'll be able to do it. If not, it's not the end of the world. Like, Blu-ray players, like, it's not a thing I do frequently. And it's only for a small subset of movies, so I'll just keep sticking the discs in.
Although my solution doesn't have fan noise either.
But you're missing out on the things that John's eyeballs can't even see. And he'll know that he's missing out on it.
I can see them.
So a couple thoughts, mostly on what Marco had said. I'd like to completely agree with him about Make MKV. It is wonderful, especially as paired with, if you're willing to recompress stuff, Don Melton's compression scripts, which we've talked about in the past. And I believe I've written a post about it at some point or another. If I have, I'll put it in the show notes.
Oh, yeah. Those are awesome. But like nowadays, like recompressing Blu-ray is still, even on modern hardware, still a very computer intensive, pretty long running process. And you can just run them in a batch overnight, but it still takes a lot. And if you have any way to use 3.5-inch hard drives as your storage medium, so any way, whether that's external drives in your desk or a NAS in the closet full of disks, whatever it is, 3.5-inch hard drives are so massive and cheap these days that you just have basically infinite storage space if you can use those drives somehow. And so I just, these days I rip them all from Blu-rays, and the whole Wire series is 560 gigs from Subler, and it doesn't matter at all.
Most feature films are 30 or 40 gigs, I think, something like that. And The Wire is considerably longer than that. And to go back one more step, you were talking, and I know you said it jokingly about, oh, some illegal way that Plex gets the metadata. I don't believe it's legal at all. They don't use IMDb, which I presume is for some sort of licensing reason or something. But they do use the TV database, which is the TVDB.com, and the movie database, which is the MovieDB.org. And we'll put those links in the show notes. Those are less geared around browsing, in my opinion, who did what and when, and more about getting metadata about films, which is probably why Plex uses it. But they are, to the best of my knowledge, completely legal.
What about like all the copyrighted material on them? Is that like, is it one of those weird gray areas, or is it?
You mean like the Google image search for movie posters? They right. Just shove them in there? Probably not really.
Oh, well, that's true, actually. Yeah, I didn't think about that. I don't know. But anyway, anything else on video and that sort of thing? We have one other piece of follow-up real quick.
Oh, I do have a quick bit of follow-up on my HDMI CEC situation.
Mm.
The setting was off.
I told you so.
That's a Casey debugged your problem last
You're
week.
Right. Yeah. Yep. I hadn't checked. I didn't even know you could turn it off, so I hadn't checked it. And it was on, but like it worked for months. Somehow it turned off. It's pretty deep in the settings. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have accidentally done that since I never go to the settings screen. But I don't know. Maybe one of the software updates might have turned it off. I don't know.
One of the features of CEC is that it can turn off CEC.
Oh, goodness gracious. All right. The last piece of follow-up we have from friend of the show, Matt Bischoff. John, I think, especially was talking last episode about what ingredients are in what ice creams. And, you know, hey, it's in John's opinion, if I recall correctly, he said there should only be a handful of ingredients in any true and decent ice cream. And Matt Bischoff has done a survey of many of the popular ice cream brands that we've mentioned and even a couple of others, and put together an Airtable, which is a site I've never heard of before, but it's very cool. It looks like basically a Google Sheet or Excel spreadsheet, if you will, but also a little bit more than that. And so you can see all the different ingredients. Matt has included the ingredient count, calorie per serving, serving size, calories per gram, and even links, because he is that thorough. Is there anything that guy doesn't do pretty much perfectly? I doubt it. But anyway, worth checking out. John, now that you've seen this, any opinions on any of this stuff?
A lot of people wanted to write in and tell me why all those ingredients are in there. I know why they're in there. Unfortunately, the list of ingredients doesn't tell you what I really want to know, which I should have emphasized last time, is how much of this stuff. All right, so the things that we're talking about that are not things that you would put in ice cream that you make in your own house with your ice cream maker, which, by the way, is really easy and everyone should do. It doesn't even take up a lot of room. You should get one. They're fun. Is they're putting in ingredients to make it so that when the ice cream thaws and then refreezes, you don't get those big chunky ice crystals. You ever do that if you with any ice cream, whether you buy it from the store or whatever, like it thaws a little bit, and like, or if your refrigerator or freezer, like your kid leaves the door open or something, or the power goes out for a long time and everything kind of like melts a little bit, but then it refreezes, and then you take the ice cream, like, oh, you can tell that it's melted and refrozen. Someone can find a physics video on YouTube explaining how like the ice crystals, like the water separates from the non-water parts and then it forms larger ice crystals and it tastes all crunchy and gross and you don't like that. It's bad. Egg yolk is an example of an emulsifier, essentially, that will keep the things mixed together, kind of like how egg yolk and like a salad dressing will keep the oil and the vinegar mixed together. It will keep them from separating. Same thing. It'll keep like the water from separating from the solid ingredients and making the big ice crystals when it remelts. Egg yolks are more expensive, obviously. Almost all the other things they put in, these various gums and other, what they call stabilizers, they're called stabilizers because they want to account for the fact that the ice cream is going to be shipped from far away in trucks with imperfect refrigeration, and it's going to melt and refreeze and melt and refreeze and melt and refreeze. And if it didn't have these stabilizers in them, it would taste terrible. It would just be like, big, chunky, water, sharp ice crystals in there. It doesn't taste good. You want it to be smooth and creamy. So the cheaper ice creams, in addition to this thing, what is it called? Overrun, I forget what the hell it's called, how much air they blow into it to make you buy air instead of densely packed things. That's why Haagen-Dazs is more dense than regular stuff. But anyway, setting aside the air thing, because some people just like a softer ice cream. The cheaper the ice cream, the more stabilizer they put in it. And they put lots and lots of stabilizers that can be very resilient to freezing and thawing. And they don't have to put any egg yolks or any other more expensive ingredient in there. And it still, seems smooth and creamy no matter where you get it. So it's not just that there are stabilizers, it's how much. And the ingredient list doesn't tell you how much because they don't have amounts. It's just an order by, the most, the ingredients that there's the most of and then the second most and so on and so forth. But it doesn't give you numbers. And my impression of the worst ice cream flavors is they have a lot of stabilizers and a lot of other things that affect texture and stuff, and that there's more of them. That, you know, like if Haagen-Dazs, a couple of their flavors have some stabilizers in them, but not a lot, is my impression. And then other ones that have the exact same ingredient list taste like I'm eating, I don't know, foam rubber or something. It just doesn't taste right or taste natural. So that's, and this list, like going down to Cold Stone Creamery having 17 ingredients, including like ethyl alcohol and artificial flavor, whatever that is, and triethyl citrate, and, you know, all sorts of other things to affect the color, the flavor, and then to avoid all those ice crystals and everything. And what I heard from somebody was that, I don't know if it was Twitter or someone emailing me or something, about Haagen-Dazs, for example, how can they get away with not having stabilizers in, for example, their vanilla ice cream? How can they do that? Because apparently they own their distribution chain and they own their own refrigerated trucks, and they basically make sure that their ice cream never melts and refreezes. Because if you were to melt and refreeze Haagen-Dazs, I've done it, we've had power outages and stuff, it tastes terrible. It's got all the ice crystals formed in it. No stabilizers, except for egg yolks, which are expensive, right? So anyway, try making your own ice cream. Try avoiding the ice creams, not that have any stabilizers in them, but that basically taste like you're eating a big thing of plastic, and you'll be happier.
Yeah, I mean, just try avoiding the ones whose ingredients sound like jet fuel is basically a good rule here.
Also, a quick follow-up. A handful of people wrote me to say, I didn't know that Dreyer's or Breyer's was Edie's where you are, and so on and so forth. And apparently, I got myself very mixed up about what's Edie's versus Dreyer's versus Breyer's. And so I had commented that the slow churned, which I think I had attributed to Dreyer's, the slow churned, which is the low fat ice cream, is actually my favorite by taste ice cream, which I know John really, really hates. And somebody wrote, not only me, but Edie's Ice Cream on Twitter to say, you know, hey, what's the story? I thought that was Edie's. And it is Edie's where I am. I had been confused, and Edie's Ice Cream has written, Edie's is called Dreyer's west of the Rocky Mountains, and just FYI, it's delicious no matter what you call it. Thank you, Edie's social media team, for correcting my unbelievable faux pas.
That's one of my least favorite brands of ice cream, Edie's. Yeah, but I should recognize the container. It's the same. Dreyer's just has a different word on it. It's kind of like the Hellman's and Best Foods mayonnaise situation. One flavor of Edie's, though, is a flavor, this ties into last week, that I don't think is available anywhere else, that I think tastes pretty terrible and does not taste like, it tastes very artificial to me, and yet I still find myself eating it, which is probably bad, is that they make a flavor that has basically Samoas mixed into the ice cream.
Oh, I tried that. I found it overwhelmingly like artificial and weird tasting.
Oh, yeah, totally. It totally tastes like you're eating like puffy plastic with Samoas in it.
Yes.
And yet I still find myself eating it. So that's like, I would never buy it willingly, but sometimes it appears in the house. And when it does appear in the house, I usually won't touch Edie's at all, but that one I will take some. I always feel bad. I always stop myself after a little tiny bit and put it back. But yeah, I mean, that's the draw of the Samoas, I guess. But I'm repulsed by the ice cream, but drawn by the broken up cookies.
Our first sponsor tonight is Trunk Club. Shopping takes forever and nobody has time for it. Now it's summertime, you probably need a solid pair of shorts and some swimwear for all your offshore activities, and it would be nice to have somebody else pick all these things out for you. With Trunk Club, you don't ever have to set foot in a store, and you get your very own stylist for free. And this is not like a robot stylist, they just like put an icon on screen, it's an actual human being stylist who works with you. Trunk Club makes it easy to look your best in clothes that fit you perfectly, handpicked by your own personal stylist. Go to trunkclubs.com/ATP, type in your measurements, share your likes and dislikes, and then your very own stylist picks out clothes for you from over 80 top brands, and they ship them to your door in this box they call a trunk, right? So here's how this works. You can keep these things for up to 10 days, try them on, feel them out, keep what you like, and just send back what you don't, and they just charge you for what you like. It is not just a regular way to shop online. Your stylist is taking the time to understand your unique look, and if you live in Dallas, New York, LA, Chicago, or DC, you can even go to one of their retail stores, they call them clubhouses, to work with your stylist in person for free. All this is free service here, and you just pay for the clothes. Now, this is not a subscription service. You can request them to send you the trunk of clothes at any frequency you want. It could be never. It could be once a year. It could be once a week. Whatever you want, you request them to send you a box of new stuff. You have up to 10 days to figure out whether you want to keep any of it or not. You keep what you want. They charge you for that. You send the rest back. And that's it. It's risk-free. There's no subscription fee, no auto billing, nothing like that.
I had no idea that wasn't subscription.
Yeah, it isn't subscription, and it's for men and women, by the way. So make a statement at the next big event on your calendar with a look that's handpicked just for you and your style. Get started at Trunk Club today. This is premium clothes, expert advice from real human stylists with no work from you. Go to trunkclub.com/ATP to get started today. Once again, that's trunkclub.com/ATP. Thanks a lot for sponsoring.
I have done a terrible job with my duties as chief summarizer in chief, and I have not done my homework. I've pulled a Marco, and I apologize to everyone.
Welcome. It's nice over here, really.
It was very relaxing, I will admit. So apparently something has happened with iCloud versus Dropbox for Scrivener. Is that how you pronounce it? Scrivener syncing. And I don't know which one of you put this in the show notes, but I will kick it over to you to take over my duties and the mantle of...
Can you guess?
Yeah, I figured it was you, but...
I also didn't hear about this, so this is going to be a short segment, I think.
Whee! All right, John, tell us about Scrivener, if you please.
This is semi-old news, and I bring it brought up to the top because it ties into our past discussions about APFS and the cloning of entire directory hierarchies without having to like go down and copy each individual file just to clone a whole tree of the file system in a copy and write manner, which is good for Apple's file formats that are actually folders full of files. Well, so Scrivener is a word processing application for like, I think it's designed mostly for writing like books. You can have like notes and your outlines and plot summary and character information all tied together with your manuscript of the book that you're writing and everything. And it uses a file format that's also a directory full of files. So you can have all these different things. It's basically like a big project format, right? And they have a syncing system. And they were going to use iCloud apparently, but were not able to because it doesn't provide the features they need to sync their directory full of files things. They're trying to be nice. As much as we love iCloud, this is from this webpage we'll link in the show notes, current from the Scrivener people themselves, current limitations and difficulties with iCloud mean it's not great at present. It's not at present suited for the sort of complex package-based file format used by Scrivener. And you would think it would be totally suited for that because Apple has those file formats too. And, you know, the next operating system is sort of the genesis of those file formats or the popularization of them anyway. But no. Dropbox, on the other hand, which is what they do use for their sync solution, gives them the control they need. And one of their big complaints about iCloud is they don't know when things will sync. It's not as if they can initiate a sync and get notified when it's done. Things just magically appear behind the scenes in sort of a background manner. And that can leave this file format, this folder full of files, in an unknown and inconsistent state. And so what they say in this blog post about these technical limitations is they'd rather have users complaining that they don't like manually syncing than just lost 4 hours of writing because of structural changes. Like, you could end up with a document. Like, if you sync and you think you're done and you close the lid on your laptop but didn't really finish, you've got like a half-finished document there. And that's bad. And Dropbox apparently gives them the control to sync the whole thing on demand, let them know when it's done, and either have the thing entirely synced or entirely in the previous state. It's clear with Apple's new file system that they will have, at least on the local side, the ability to do these operations atomically, but their iCloud APIs with the sort of magic, oh, you don't need to know the details, just there's a folder there, and eventually the documents you want will appear everywhere, and in the meantime, there's like proxy documents that you can get metadata about, and so on and so forth. It doesn't work when what you care about is not an individual file, but an entire directory full of files, because apparently the iCloud drive and sync people weren't on the same page with the people writing .rtfd files in text editor. Maybe it doesn't matter when you've got a half-finished .rtfd file, and they assume it will sync in the rest of the way. Anyway, this is yet another sad story of a developer who desperately wants to use iCloud, eventually having to go to a different solution. Very often developers roll their own solutions, or they go with Dropbox, or they go with something else. It's sort of the ongoing failure of iCloud to fulfill even the most basic needs of some of the best developers of Mac applications, or iOS applications for that matter.
File syncing or data syncing is hard in general, and I think what we see is iCloud Drive, you know, it's another one of these examples where, like, when iCloud interacts with the file system, it's not always great. It seems like CloudKit and what they've made with CloudKit is able to be really great. With certain apps, with certain things that go well, it's able to be really great. But whenever iCloud interacts with like files on disk that have to exist in a file system and be interacted with in other ways as well, that seems like it's not even there yet. And I worry about that a little bit, but, you know, we have other solutions for that. We have Dropbox. We have, well, Dropbox. And it seems to work well for most people, so I guess it's okay now. I guess it's okay in the grand scheme of things, but it is kind of sad that Apple is still not really playing well in that game.
I mean, on an individual file basis, they have most of this, because the whole idea is the difference between an API where you say, please do sync now, like even a synchronous API where you say, make this call, and when the call returns, the thing I asked to be done is done. That can work on an individual file basis, and CloudKit is much more like that in that you have the control over that. I'm not sure if they're complaining about CloudKit specifically or iCloud Drive that does it like magically behind their back, but all of that is on a individual file. There's no sort of like, oh, this entire tree of files, I want you to sync all of that and tell me when all of that is done, unless you're going to try to do each individual one, and then what about files that have been added or removed? There's no API for to do things at that level. And the related thing that came up today, this is about the Sierra beta. Maybe I shouldn't say who's reporting this, because I don't know what you're supposed to say about the Sierra betas. Is it a public beta? I don't know. I don't even know the rules anymore. But anyway, we all know from the keynote that macOS Sierra has this feature where it will automatically sync your desktop. Remember that? Like all the stuff on your desktop between your Macs, and also apparently your documents folder. I forget what it is. When I installed it, there's like a checkbox or something that says, hey, do you want like Apple to sync all the stuff in your documents folder and desktop? And I was like, hell no. for the reasons discussed in the past, like, please don't. Anyway, so someone we all know checked that checkbox just to see what it was like, and like, la-di-da, it's sync, especially if you have one computer, la-di-da, it's syncing the stuff or whatever. And at some point, they said, all right, I want to stop doing that, and like uncheck the checkbox. And when you uncheck it, it's like that, you know, the phrasing they use, like when you go into the iCloud preference pane and uncheck like contacts or something or whatever, and it's like, keep in mind that the whatevers will no longer be available on your Mac. You know that yep. phrasing? Mm-hmm. It's like their way, they don't want to say we're going to delete your stuff, but they're like, whatever you're talking about will no longer be available on your Mac, or some wording like that. And I don't know if people really know what that means. I mean, it's accurate, but it means like your stuff go bye-bye now. Like it's not going to be there anymore. We are going to delete it. And this person who was checking this box is like, but this is my documents folder. Surely they don't mean they'll remove everything in my documents folder if I uncheck this checkbox, right? So this person unchecked it, and lo and behold, their documents, everything in their documents folder went away. Like everything. And now, it's not really gone. Apparently, like the system is squirreling it away in a different location. If you know where you can you know find it, it's still there. Like, and you can make it come back because it's synced and all that other stuff. But this is probably working like as designed. But this is a terrifying design, because I don't think people expect it to happen. I think people mostly do keep everything that they care about on their desktop and in their documents folder. And if they were to uncheck a checkbox and everything disappeared, even if they can get it back by rechecking, the panic and the trust lost by that interaction is terrible. And then the other part of that is, if anything does go wrong and you check the checkbox to try to get it back and it gives you back like an old version of the file or something, like it, which, you know, could happen because sync is really hard, that's going to be just insult on top of injury. It'd be terrible. So I really hope they reconsider this interface and the whole idea that there's a series of checkboxes that you can check to make stuff. Like, one of the most important sort of user interface decisions that Dropbox made was that the files in Dropbox, we'll talk about this more if we ever get to Dropbox, is Project Infinite, which changes this decision, but the files in your Dropbox folder are just plain files on your Mac. If you turn Dropbox off, those files are still sitting on your Mac exactly where they were. If you never run Dropbox again, those files are still just sitting there, right? They're not, Dropbox doesn't like control those files to the point where like, oh, you quit Dropbox, your entire Dropbox folder is empty. No, they're just files on your disk. And when you turn Dropbox on, it looks at it as Dropbox folder and syncs them all and does all this stuff or whatever. But when you turn it off, or if Dropbox crashes in the middle, everything is just exactly the way it was, because they're just real files on your disk. And yes, that means that if you have five computers all using Dropbox, you have five individual different copies of those same files. And if you uninstall Dropbox from all of them, now all five computers have the same files on them, but they're just plain files on disk. Same is true of iCloud Drive, but the policy of saying when you uncheck this checkbox, the only way we can deal with it is to remove these things from your documents folder, from your desktop, or just blank it out, or put them into a different folder even, or do anything with them at all other than to leave them exactly where they are, is the wrong decision, even if it works perfectly. So anyway, Sierra is a beta. I don't know if this was an intended feature, a bug, anything, you know, plenty of asterisks and caveats on this. I'm not slamming an unreleased operating system, but I really hope when this feature does exist that it has a better policy than that, and even if it doesn't, still not enabling it, because I still find it really scary.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those problems where, you know, when you have like the folder full of files that need to be synced, there are so many weird little uncomfortable edge cases or areas where you need some kind of administrator tool. So, for instance, any kind of merge conflict or like what Dropbox does, we learned about with our discussion about file names, that apparently like Dropbox will create like a conflict if you have two different Unicode encodings of the same name. It will just leave them both there, and it'll rename one or both of them like naming conflict or something like that, right? And if you have a merge conflict in Dropbox, it keeps both or all three files, and it just renames them with parentheses at the end, like, oh, you know, conflict version, whatever the format they use. And these are all kind of ugly solutions to real world conditions. But these are the kind of like ugly results that you kind of can't automate this away in a way that will never lose data for people, or that will always do exactly what people want it to do. But Apple tries to. So Apple seems like they're kind of institutionally allergic to adding in these kind of like administrative ugliness things that even when they have to be there, like a case like a merge conflict on a file share thing, like a Dropbox folder. Apple's solution is usually, we're just going to guess and hope that we guess right through some kind of heuristics that will probably be right most of the time, and we'll just deal with it. Like, that'll just be the way it's dealt with, and if you lose data, oh well. Like, that seems to be their approach most of the time to these kind of, like, difficult sync problems. But I don't think that works very well in an environment where you have, like, people's files in folders that have always worked a certain way that people are accustomed to, that people expect, and that people require for their data to be, you know, there and reliable and intact and everything. Like, Apple's approach to just, we're just going to avoid giving you any kind of controls to manage the actual complexity of this problem, I don't think that works for files.
One of the advancements of CloudKit was that it would delegate to the application to make this decision, to say, CloudKit will let you know that there's a conflict, and you'll get this callback, and it's up to you what to do about it. And you could decide in your application, I'm just going to keep all three copies and rename them with parentheses, right? This situation with the iCloud Drive or whatever, the syncing of the desktop stuff, is, like I said, it's more of a policy decision of saying, what should we do when they uncheck that box? I think the right decision when they uncheck that box is to just leave everything exactly the way it is on disk and not mess with it anymore. But the decision they're making is kind of the same decision they make for contacts or, I don't know, all the other things that you can check and uncheck in the iCloud preference pane. Sometimes in the iCloud preference pane, they ask you, should we remove the ones or leave them on your Mac? They should ask the same thing for the documents, which again, which makes you think maybe this isn't an intentional feature. They just haven't gotten around to that, to change that dialog box in that way. But, it just goes to show that there are lots of things that you can do to confuse and frighten the user. And perhaps the worst one is making all their stuff apparently disappear. Even if it's all safely preserved, both locally in a different folder that they renamed and on the cloud, that moment of trust, you know, of you losing the user's trust is going to make them not want to use that product anymore. And Dropbox, with the renaming, with the garbage files and everything, my experience is that happens to people and they don't even notice until like a month later. And like, what is this whatever's conflicted copy file here? I don't quite understand that. But the reason they didn't notice is because it didn't actually delete anything. It always fails in a way that gives you extra data, extra garbage files of like, well, I've got the file that I expected and I've got two more that I didn't expect. But you've got all three versions of the file. And if one of them is named differently and you can't figure it out, like you go there and you sort by name and you'll find there's a bunch of other files with similar, you'll find your stuff. Like it won't, as opposed to trying to pick the correct file for you or presenting some dialogue for you to choose how to resolve the conflict when you don't have enough information to do that. So Dropbox's solution is not great for a lot of situations where you don't want it making a bunch of garbage files, but it's a good choice for just sort of a generic bin full of, folder full of files without any specific purpose, because their strategy is the worst thing we can do is lose someone's data. It's much better to give them a bunch of garbage files than to make stuff disappear.
Why do you think that Google Drive and like OneDrive and to some degree Box haven't tried to be that like everything sync engine that Dropbox has seemed to become?
They are trying. They have different policies. Like I think Google Drive is very similar to Dropbox. I haven't actually used OneDrive, but all of them, all these products, including Dropbox now with the Project Infinite thing, are dancing around the other trade-off. Like Dropbox's thing of, hey, every single file is on your Mac and we will sync it. And then they added selective sync many years ago where you can choose which files you want to sync. Dropbox Infinite is, all right, will make it look like the files, this is my understanding, I haven't actually used it, will make it look like the files are on your Mac, but really they'll be in the cloud, which makes a lot of sense in a pervasively network-connected office, and it'll let you, like, pin, I'm assuming it will let you pin files to your Mac so they don't go away. It's so you can have basically more stuff in your Dropbox than will fit on your Mac, or, like, selective on-demand selective sync, sort of like you're paging in the files from the cloud onto your Mac as you use them, and as you don't use them, they don't need to be on your Mac. Or you could say, never bring this all the way on my Mac, just sort of access it over the network. It's sort of a blending of NFS mounts and Dropbox complete copying of files and all that other stuff. And it does that with a kernel extension. There's a whole article about it on Dropbox's thing. It's very interesting, but it's a very different trade-off than Dropbox makes. And it's much more dangerous because if they mess anything up there, bad things could happen. Like, the reassurance of Dropbox, like I said, is that you can quit the Dropbox app, never relaunch it again, and everything in that Dropbox folder is exactly, you know, what you see is what's there. None of those files are fake. None of them are proxy files. They're all there. They're all taking up disk space on your Mac. You don't have to wonder which ones are where. And, you know, you can move things in and out of it. They're not constrained in any way. They don't have weird permissions on them. They're just plain old files. And Project Infinite takes that away in exchange for you not having to deal with selective sync and have you, you know, fill up your disk because someone in a shared folder puts a ton of stuff in there and all sorts of other downsides of the traditional Dropbox model. But it's a much higher degree of difficulty. And I think a lot of the other vendors went right for that higher degree of difficulty and never sort of started off as simple as Dropbox. The advantage Dropbox had, I think, is that, you know, even before selective sync, it was a very simple user model that people could understand, didn't have a lot of features, was so simple it could be implemented by a bunch of Python scripts, for crying out loud. And I think Dropbox built a lot of trust and goodwill with that simple model, and now they can expand. Like, as they expand to selective sync, that didn't cause people to flee because it was too confusing, because it was just a tweak of the thing they understood. We'll see if Project Infinite is a bridge too far, but I think that's the big advantage that Dropbox had that I think big companies like Google and Microsoft can't help but immediately implement all the complicated features.
Do you plan on trying Dropbox Infinite?
I doubt it. I mean, I'm not dissatisfied with the plain Dropbox. I have a lot of disk space. I do use selective sync sometimes to keep things, you know, from getting too big, because I do have some shared folders, and I really hate Dropbox's policy of, like, shared folders count towards your quota, which is ridiculous because you know they're only storing one copy of this stuff server side. Probably won't, especially since it uses a kernel extension, but I will be curious about it, so I won't rule it out.
Yeah, I don't actually plan to try it, honestly. I mean, maybe if, you know, on a laptop, I might try it. On my main computer, I definitely wouldn't. I'd rather just buy more hard drive space and just suck it up than run those risks and everything. But on a laptop, maybe.
Yeah, I don't have that much stuff in my Dropbox. Well, I have 9 gigs available, of which I've used a little over half of it. So there's 4 gigs, a little more, maybe even 5 gigs in there. But it's not that much, and even the smallest laptop can grab all of that. I'm still on a free Dropbox plan. I haven't had a need to pay for it. I'm not opposed to paying for it. I just haven't had the need to pay for it. So
I actually just started paying for it at WWDC this year. Like, that's my I finally bought it.
So what puts you over the edge?
I wanted an easy way to quickly have a backup of the podcast files that we had recorded there. And it was just easier than setting up something else at that moment in the very brief time that I was sitting in the fast Ethernet area of Moscone.
Fair enough.
And I thought, you know what, I kept hitting it, because I only had, like, the regular 2 gig limit plus, like, a couple hundred megs or something, but I kept running into that all the time with just, like, transferring podcast files back and forth. I'm like, you know, this is, you know, it's about time. Let me actually finally pay for this product that I've been using and running my business on for literally years.
Yeah. Makes sense. And I also kind of like that the Synology has what, like, Cloud Sync or something like that, which puts a copy of Dropbox on the Synology, which is neat as another backup.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think it's called Cloud Sync. There's one of the apps that you can install. I'll have to get you the name after the show. One of the apps you can install basically acts as another Dropbox client. And so if you wanted to, you could have an additional backup of your Dropbox sitting on your Synology.
Our second sponsor this week is Eero. go to eero.com. That's eero.com/ATP. Now imagine if your electricity didn't reach certain parts of the house or were intermittent in certain parts of the house. That would be ridiculous, right? But this is the status quo for Wi-Fi, with dead zones and buffering affecting far too many of us. Eero is designed to change all of this. Eero manufactures a single device. It's a small, elegant box about the size of an Apple TV, and it's a Wi-Fi router. And the idea is, with the help of their dead simple app, you put multiple Eero devices in your home. The first one replaces your router. It acts as the regular router. You plug in Ethernet to it for your internet connection, and you plug it into your cable modem or your DSL modem, and that's it. And then you can plug in any number of additional Eeros just in regular outlets. You don't have to wire them to your connection. You just plug them into an electric outlet. And then they all connect wirelessly to each other and form a mesh network that blankets your home in fast, reliable Wi-Fi. Now, the single router model just doesn't work. We all know this. We've all tried single routers, especially many of them that advertise long range or are covered in a bunch of ugly antennas. And they always say that they're going to cover your whole house, and they never do. There's always low reception zones or slow zones or dead zones, always. What you need is a distributed system with multiple access points. That's what Eero gives you. It is really fast and easy to set up, super easy to use. The devices, the actual Eero routers are nice and small, and you don't have to wire any of them except the very first one to your actual internet connection. And they have incredible support if you need it. Of course, it's all encrypted. It's all fast. It is really a great solution to this problem. They recommend one Eero for every roughly 1,000 square feet, so a typical U.S. home is probably going to have two or three of them. A three-pack is a great starting point. Check it out today. Go to Eero.com. That's Eero.com/ATP. If you enter code ATP, you will get free overnight shipping. Once again, Eero.com, Eero.com/ATP. And use overnight shipping for free with code ATP. Thanks a lot to Eero for sponsoring our show once again.
Apparently Hackintoshes are still a thing, and Mike Rundle just built one. And that's about the extent of my knowledge on this scenario. So John, tell us about this.
Yeah, don't call it a comeback. People are always doing the Hackintosh thing. It came up again because someone did another blog post about it. And as we've been talking about for weeks on the show about how it's basically the wrong time to buy any Mac because they're all woefully out of date, with the exception of the 5K iMac, maybe, and I guess the little MacBook, I suppose, because that's fairly up to date. But everything else is just has incredibly old hardware. There's been lots of snarky tweets about it involving the store. I think someone, Marco, retweeted somebody saying, used to be that you made a Hackintosh to get yourself a cheap Macintosh. Now you do a Hackintosh just so you can run macOS on hardware that is not insanely outdated. Like it's not a money saving move, and it's not even like I want to build this amazing beast of a box type of move. It's more like I just want to run my preferred operating system on hardware that was made in the past year or two, and so that's Apple's fault for letting that stuff go by. But every time someone builds one of these Hackintosh, people are amazed that you can essentially build a PC, which is what modern Macs are when you get down to brass tacks in terms of the components, for an incredibly small amount of money. So this was a $1,200 Hackintosh that's like trumps any computer you could buy from Apple at any price for the most part. Particularly galling are things like how cheap the RAM can be. Now, it's not apples to apples, but like, oh, well, the Mac Pro has ECC RAM, and that's why it costs more money, and all these other excuses for why the RAM is so much more expensive. But Will Cosgrove tweeted just before the show, Apple charges $1,300 for 64 gigabytes of DDR3 RAM for the Mac Pro. You can get 64 gigabytes of DDR4 RAM for $275. So that is $275 versus $1,300. Good. For the same amount of RAM, just drop the ECC. Yeah.
And granted, it is ECC versus not, but that is, that does affect the price, yeah. But not that much.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's nonsensical. Like the price of the Mac Pro is crazy pants.
I will say, though, with this particular case, this particular Hackintosh, it is not using a Xeon. It is not using a server chipset. It is not using ECC RAM. It is really an iMac, not a Mac Pro comparison here. This, and there, it is still a good comparison to make. However, this is not making a very cheap Mac Pro. This is making a very cheap iMac.
But it's way faster than the Mac Pro, though, in every measurable way. So it doesn't really matter.
Isn't it literally the exact same CPU that's sold in the 5K iMac?
Probably. I mean, the 5K iMac is faster than the Mac Pro. Like, you know, except for in massively parallel things where you got a 12-core, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is a $1,200 computer. Like,
agreed. However, it is an insult to the iMac, not the Mac Pro.
Yeah, well, it's an insult to Apple's entire line. And this particular Hackintosh, whatever. You can find a million different Hackintosh builds. You can build it. That's the whole point of Hackintosh, is you can build it any way you want. And so a lot of people have been asking us whether we would ever do a Hackintosh or whether this is something we've considered, because we've been complaining so much about the outdated Apple hardware. And I'll speak for myself and say, I look at this and it makes me sad about Apple's product line, but I had never really considered making one myself, because I don't want to have to deal with any of the stuff that Hackintoshes have to deal with. They have to deal with a lot of the stuff because Apple doesn't make an operating system for just sort of any sort of hardware. So they have to carefully match their hardware to what Apple provides drivers for, or to what they can get drivers for. And it's become even harder with the driver signing thing and everything. Lots of features, lots of major features just don't work on the Hackintoshes, because they haven't figured out how to convince the operating system to make hardware that is similar enough to Mac hardware that things will work. In particular, one that really stood out to me in this particular Hackintosh story is they still haven't gotten iMessage working. And that's not like a minor feature.
Yeah, that's
like
a big
iMessage
thing.
iMessage is a pretty, like, would you like to use a Mac, but by the way, you can't use iMessage? And forget about all the modern stuff that it requires, like handoff continuity, or, you know, the Touch ID sensor that will appear on MacBook someday. Forget about that stuff, because that's no way they're going to be able to do that. They're not going to get a secure enclave from Apple and stick it into their PC and get the stuff to work. So the amount of things that just don't work that make your Mac not really a Mac is a growing list of things. And Apple, not that they're doing it to stop Hackintoshes, but Apple keeps adding to that list. And I don't want to deal with any of that. I just want it to work. I don't want to do a point update and have my machine not boot because the video drivers don't work anymore. I don't want to have to worry about any of that stuff. I just want a really good, big, fast, and I'm willing to pay much more money for the privilege of someone figuring this all out ahead of time and making me, and this is a nice piece of hardware that works. And this is before I get into like how ugly these boxes are and how much noise they might make and all the other, and the fact that you have to build it yourself. And like, I would sooner build myself a gaming PC than I would a Hackintosh. Like, gaming PC, I've come really close to building many times in my various states of frustration, but a Hackintosh, never for me.
Casey?
Oh, would I build one? Hell no. Absolutely not.
But you built PCs before, right?
Oh yeah. For a long time. Basically up until the time I started using ThinkPads exclusively, which was right before I started using MacBooks exclusively, which was before I started using the iMac. I was always building PCs. Always. And first of all, I'm so far out of the game, so to speak, like I wouldn't even know where to begin. Like, I understand the components that are necessary for a modern personal computer, but I don't know what processors are popular these days. I don't know what memory is the right memory to choose. And obviously I could figure this out, but I just don't have the patience, the time, or the energy for it. This is a thing, especially a computer where I only buy one once every like 4 to 8 years. I would much rather throw money at the problem and just have Apple fix it for me. That being said, the whole reason we're talking about this is because Apple is doing a very good job of avoiding taking our money. Well, not us, maybe John, not Marco and I necessarily, but I mean, Apple's really working hard at not updating things except the MacBook Adorable, and to some degree the iMac, like you guys said earlier. Like, what's the holdup? I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a very long span in my life where I would gladly have built a Hackintosh. I was building my own PCs at the time, and it's just like building a PC with a little bit more hassle. But, you know, I agree with what John said, that, you know, in the era of, you know, you have driver signing now, you have, you know, possible iMessage hiccups with certain Hackintosh setups and handoff and stuff being tricky to get working because of the various Wi-Fi chip hacks they do. It seems like we are pretty clearly moving towards a point in probably the near future where Hackintoshes won't work anymore.
Yeah.
Or at least enough features won't work on them that like the trade-off between pain in the buttery and whatever you're saving or gaining by having one, that might switch the other way. Because as Apple increases the pain in the buttery and the limitations and everything else, that eventually, like, it's not worth it anymore, or at least for certain people, it won't be worth it anymore. So I just feel like in my current set of priorities, I'm able to trade money for time to a certain degree. And when I was younger, like when I was in college and high school building these PCs for myself and my friends, like we had nothing but time, but we had very little money. So it made way more sense then to build our own PCs and deal with all the massive amounts of headaches and time sinks and crap that we had to deal with to build our own PCs and keep them running and keep them stable and keep them upgraded. Like it was a massive time sink for me and my friends. But we did it because, again, that time money continuum, the balance was different for us back then. Now, I think all of us involved back then would all just buy a computer, you know, from Apple and just be done with it and not have to worry about it because, quite frankly, we don't have the time to worry about it, and we do have a little bit of money to spend on them, so we can do that instead. So it all depends on, like, you know, whether it's worth it to you. And as the environment shifts, whether it's worth it will shift too. In this case, like, if Apple really does horribly neglect the Mac line for a lot longer, then I will probably be tempted just to get more performance. You know, just like in this particular case, I was disappointed to see that the high-end consumer desktop chips that are and their platforms that are being used in this particular article, the Mike Rundle article, it's the exact same chip that's available in the 5K iMac in the high-end configuration, the 4 gigahertz Skylake i7. Like, so it's not, this was not a case of doing something that Apple won't sell you, really. This was more of a case of just getting what Apple will sell you, but for way less money. And that's cool. And there's a huge market for that I totally understand. But I don't think the trade-off would be worth it to me in my current state of time versus money. What would be worth it, possibly in the future, is if Apple stops selling the Mac Pro, and for some reason OS X keeps supporting its hardware, and then I can get an 8 or 12 or 16 core high-end Xeon workstation running Mac OS X, and Apple won't sell me one. That would be very interesting to me. But today, it's just not. I don't know. The balance for me isn't there today.
Yeah, I think we're going to get MacBook Pro, and not that this is unique, but I think we're going to get MacBook Pro updates before the end of the year. And I think there's a decent shot we'll get a stupid Mac Pro update before the end of the year. I don't think it's dead, based on no facts, just a guess. I don't think it's dead. But I should, to go back to Hackintosh specifically for a moment, when I was debating very publicly with you, Marco, whether or not I should get a Mac. This is 2008-ish, I believe. And we were having this debate via reblogs of each other's posts on Tumblr. What I ended up doing was taking my then ThinkPad T30, I believe it was, and putting a Hackintosh version of Leopard, I believe it was at the time. I might have that wrong. And running it for a few days just to see if I liked, you know, OS X. And to my recollection, Wi-Fi didn't work, but onboard Ethernet did. And just about everything else did, too. Maybe sound didn't, actually. I don't recall. But I remember vividly that Wi-Fi didn't work, which was a major bummer. But I really liked it. And it was relatively pain-free to do. I think I acquired some version of OS X that had been prepared for this sort of use. And that's what I used to install it, and it worked pretty darn well. And if it wasn't for that, I probably still would have bought the Mac anyway, but I felt a lot more confident in doing so. But just like you said, you hit the nail on the head. You know, today, the three of us can trade money for time, if you will. And when we were in college and kids, when we were building computers, well, except John, we had plenty of time to kill and not a lot of money. So it's funny how things change.
It's not just the time, too. It's like thinking of your poor haunted iMac that could die at any second. What you're also paying for, what you're also paying for, is someone to blame.
That's true.
Yeah.
If your computer goes wonky, you have someone to blame, and that's Apple. If your computer continues to be wonky, continues to behave badly, you can keep bringing it back to Genius Bar. Eventually, they'll replace it with an all new computer. If you know, not that that's a fun thing to do. Like, it's still a pain in the butt. But if you build your own Hackintosh and it starts being wonky, you have no one to go to. You certainly can't go to Apple. You can't go to your motherboard manufacturer. You can't go to your GPU vendor. You can't go to the company that made the case. You can't go to the monitor vendor. Like, you've just got yourself. And so Hackintoshes, I mean, they're way cheaper, but they're not free. So that's, you know, that's potentially $1,000 or more that you spent on something. And if it stops working or starts being weird in some way, unless it is a hardware fault, like, oh, my GPU died or my CPU died, like if it just starts being flaky, because again, it's Hackintosh, it's running, you know, an unsupported hardware configuration that you're trying to hack to get to work. And by the way, it's not like iMessage doesn't work at all. There are these strange incantations to try to get it to work by faking it out, but it's very sketchy. If things start to act weird, you've got no one to blame. And that's not tenable. Like maybe if you lived by yourself and you could handle your main computer not working or being flaky some of the time, maybe, or it was like a secondary computer, maybe you could handle that. But in any sort of family environment where any other person is relying on that computer to be a computer, to be able to sit down in front of it and like do your photos or whatever, and you know, like to do stuff on that computer and it doesn't work, and you're the one who built this computer and you have no one to blame,
it's
at that point you will say, I would love to be able to pay to have someone to blame for this other than me, because you don't want everyone looking at you and saying, why does this computer that you wasted all this time on not work anymore? And you're just like, you know, or why does it do this weird thing or whatever? So I think of that just as much as like the time I would spend tinkering. I think of being, having a single company who stands behind the supposed functionality of the entire thing. And I mean the entire thing. Like if something, you know, if something is wonky about it, like if Wi-Fi works intermittently or whatever, I don't have to prove that like the Wi-Fi, chipset or whatever is bad and like go to that manufacturer and get them to replace it and plug it in and realize it's a conflict between like the motherboard and this other, you know, like I don't have to deal with any of that. I have to deal with the hassle. It's still a hassle to go to the Apple store, especially if you're lugging a big computer with you. You still have to probably go back three times, but eventually you'll get some kind of satisfaction. Whereas if you built it yourself, at a certain point, you're just like, sell the parts off individually and try again. It's really grim.
Yeah, I mean, I've been, like, as I said, like I built a good number of computers for myself and my friends throughout high school and college, and I've been in that position of like something doesn't work, especially if it's not even on my computer. It usually wasn't. Something doesn't work on one of my friend's computers, or worse, on a computer that somebody paid me a little bit of money to build for them, and like there's just, it's just an endless sinkhole of time and possibly my own money trying to, you know, resolve this problem, and meanwhile dealing with a very upset person who is very annoyed that this computer that they paid a good amount of money to, even though I didn't get most of it, but they paid a good amount of money for all the parts and everything, and I told them I could do it, and then something goes wrong and I'm on the hook for it. It sucks, and I gladly would have paid to have like somebody else deal with it. But at the time, I didn't have a lot of money. That was the whole reason I was doing this. And there was nobody that I even could have paid to help out. And it was horrible.
On the flip side of this, Mike Rundle, Hackintosh here, the biggest feature for me is not the fact that it's always a cheaper iMac, is that he could pick any GPU that he wanted to put in there. And he put in a better one that's in the iMac, and he could have put an even better one there. And in fact, he can change his mind 2 years later and get an even better GPU. And that's an option Apple doesn't give you at all. Apple will give you that CPU. They will not give you this GPU or the option to put in a better one.
I mean, this sounds impressive, but I agree that without iMessage on this Mac, no thanks. Hard pass.
Well, yeah, it's this balance, right? Like, and I think what we're all saying is like we all would have reasons why we might want to build one of these things if things got worse. As the conditions change, like we might build Hackintoshes in 3 years or something. Who knows? Like, we have no idea what will hold. But like if your priorities are just very slightly different, or if your needs are just very slightly different from us, you could very easily fall on the other side of that balance, and this could make total sense for you.
Yeah. Yeah, this list of things that don't work, like AirDrop I use a lot, and I think I'm the AirDrop unicorn because it almost always works for me.
I honestly have very good luck with AirDrop as well.
Yeah, all his audio doesn't work.
Yeah, like the first item, like you mentioned before, Casey, though, I think everything worked when I installed Apple, except for Wi-Fi. Oh, yeah, and audio. It's like, what is this, Linux? Wi-Fi and audio? No, minor features like Wi-Fi and audio don't work, but otherwise it's perfect.
So true.
Like, so audio true. Doesn't work, you have a non-functional computer. It's like saying, my TV is great, it's just there's no sound.
It's so true. I genuinely had forgotten that audio maybe didn't work. But yeah, looking at this list, you know, audio doesn't work. Community and handoff, continuity and handoff don't work. Those I don't use that much. iMessage doesn't work, I'm out. AirDrop doesn't work, I'm out again. Well, I was already out with audio, come to think of it, but...
And Touch ID doesn't work. Like, that's going to be... Like, Apple just keeps accumulating these things. I think once people get used to unlocking their laptop with Touch ID, a Hackintosh is going to... It's like having a Hackintosh with no Wi-Fi. You know, before Wi-Fi was a big deal, it was just added on a toilet seat to iMacs, or iBooks, rather. And it's like, well, you know, Wi-Fi doesn't work, but who uses that? And at a certain point, you're like, Wi-Fi doesn't work. This is junk. Throw it away. Like, I can't... A laptop without Wi-Fi is pointless, right? Touch ID and features like that will probably eventually feel like that. Like, I'm not going to type in my password every time I unlock my computer. That's barbaric. And so, and you can be pretty sure that it's going to be very difficult to simulate the secure enclave Touch ID hardware, whatever, that Apple adds to their laptops. Even if you can somehow source that part from the Far East and get it installed in your Hackintosh, that's a hell of a challenge.
We are sponsored by Wunder Capital, that's W-U-N-D-E-R Capital. You've probably seen the explosive growth in residential solar panel installations. Now, small and medium-sized businesses want to go solar too. But financing for commercial solar isn't available to businesses unless they have investment-grade credit. Wunder Capital, a Techstars-backed company in Boulder, Colorado, is helping to solve that problem by financing solar panel installations for small and medium-sized businesses. They've originated over $25 million worth of solar projects this year alone. If you qualify as an SEC-accredited investor, Wunder Capital offers investments in their solar funds. Your investment goes directly to helping U.S. businesses install solar PV panels. As they repay their loans to Wunder, you receive monthly interest payments. And Wunder Capital doesn't take any fees for investing your money. Wunder Capital has two funds available. The Wunder Income Fund, which targets a return of 6% per year during a 10-year period. And the Wunder Bridge Fund, which targets a return of 11% per year during a 2-year period. Both funds are asset-backed by the solar panels themselves, and please keep in mind that past performance is not an indicator of future returns. Learn more about Wunder Capital at wondercapital.com/ATP. That's W-U-N-D-E-R capital.com/ATP. Wunder Capital, do well and do good.
Speaking of Hackintoshes, I was recalling from the olden days when you two probably weren't born yet, one of the original Hackintosh type things, like in the early days of the Mac, it was very difficult to clone it. Not the least of which because you needed the Mac ROM. Most of the Mac toolbox was on the ROM chip, and that was proprietary Apple, and you couldn't really buy that part. And so it was very difficult to have any sort of legitimate commercial business selling Mac clones because you couldn't have a Mac without that ROM. And then on top of that, all the other problems. But there was one company that used to advertise in Mac magazines, like a legitimate company, I think they were in Australia, maybe, called Outbound. I'm trying to Google for it while you're going to the last ad. And my recollection is they would basically get around the cloning by buying actual real Apple stuff or requiring you to buy them or whatever and repackaging it. So they would take like a Mac Plus motherboard or a Mac SE motherboard and put it into kind of a laptop shape with a big battery and everything. So they were very, very expensive. You weren't saving any money, but you could buy a basically real Macintosh, as far as the operating system was concerned, in a case not made by Apple, simply by adding a tremendous amount of cost. It's almost kind of like when you buy like a tuner car where you're like, just buy a basic Mustang and then add $100,000, right? You start off, you start with the Mustang as delivered to you by Ford, and then you just add lots of money. So you start with a Mac SE or a Mac Plus, and then they just take out the insides, repackage them in a different thing, and sell you the new thing, and then add money on top of that.
Kind of like the Modbook people from a few years back, right?
Yeah, similar to that, but like, you know, going from a desktop computer to a laptop is quite a transition. And they had the really weird pointing device that looked like, I don't know if you guys ever saw this. I don't think it ever caught on because it's pretty terrible. If you can imagine your space bar replaced by a pencil, like, you know, a pencil, horizontal pencil, and what? If you put your thumb on the pencil, and as you roll the pencil, you know, just rolling it, that makes your cursor go up and down. And as you slide your finger left and right on the pencil, that makes the cursor go left and right.
What?
I forget what it was called.
Okay.
It was not a good pointing device. But it was an interesting way. Like, before trackpads, they wanted to have a pointing device that didn't take up a lot of room. So they didn't have the nubbin at this point. I think this predates the nubbin. And they didn't have a trackpad, and there wasn't room for that anyway. So they had below the space bar this, whatever this was, like, what is it called? IsoPoint track bar. There you go. I'm Googling. I don't know why it was called IsoPoint. Anyway, it didn't catch on for a reason. But there's a long history of people trying to essentially have a Mac, but not have a Mac. And I think everything has been tried, including actual legitimate cloning, which hopefully you guys either don't remember or have blocked out of your mind.
And that was before our time as Mac users. But I mean, like, all these things, like, these make sense. You know, like, that crazy company was around when there wasn't a Mac laptop. The people who made Modbook and everything, that was before the iPad, and there was no Mac Cintiq, basically, is what they were trying to make. And I don't know if they still make them. Anyway, and Hackintoshes are around because there's no what everyone calls the X-Mac, which is, like, there's basically no, like, cheap desktop tower Mac that's just expandable with regular slots. Like, the Mac Pro used to kind of almost be that, except it wasn't cheap, and now we don't even have that anymore. So Hackintoshes and all these things, they serve needs that Apple refuses to serve for whatever reason, whether they're not profitable or whether they're just too specialized and not enough people would buy them, or whether they don't fit into Johnny Ive's magic white room because they have too many ports and they're too expandable and, you know, they're too useful. I don't know. But Apple refuses to serve these markets. You know, they're going to get served somehow, and either they're going to get served by crappy PCs with other stuff, or they're going to get served with illegal pirated copies of OS X. I'm not really sure which is worse for Apple, but I'm guessing keeping people in the Apple ecosystem, even illegally, is probably better for Apple long term.
That's an interesting point. I don't know. This is all going to get resolved this fall when they release all the new hardware, and everyone will be happy except you two.
And Mac Mini owners will also be sad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we at least talk from this position of privilege that, like, Apple at least occasionally mentions our computers. But Mac Mini people, ooh, they're in a bad spot. Mac Mini people, like, you know, we're complaining, like, oh, our computers haven't gotten updated in, like, 2 or 3 years. Mac Mini people, that's always their condition. Like, they, since the beginning of the Mac Mini, the way they treat the Mac Mini is just insulting. It really is insulting. And the last time they updated it, they took away all the best options and all the expandability. And, you know, it's like, oh, we have it easy compared to the Mac Mini people.
I saw someone at work the other day considering, like, idly, like, I'm thinking of getting a new Mac, and I can't really decide between a 5K iMac and a Mac Mini. And it dawned on me that, for, you know, once again, dawned on me, you have to be shown it, that regular people don't keep track of what the hell's inside all the different Macs. As far as they're concerned, it's like going to a car dealership. Well, you know, we make an SUV, we make a coupe, we make a sedan, and you don't go to think, like, wait, does the sedan have, like, a steam-powered engine in it? And the coupe has an internal combustion engine, and I'm not aware of that? Like, as far as you said, well, it was really just like, you know, you don't want to buy an all-in-one computer and have the big expensive screen trapped inside of there, which is all legitimate reasons for, like, but what you don't understand is that the 5K iMac has a Skylake CPU, and the Mac Mini has, like, a Core 2 Duo, or whatever the hell is in that thing now. Like, you look on the outside, it looks like you're just, you know, trading off, like, form factor and price and everything, but really, you should not buy that Mac Mini, like, ever. Just when it was new, you shouldn't have bought it, and now you definitely shouldn't buy it. And I don't think Apple salespeople are going to emphasize that in the store, although they may be confused about, wait, you want a Mac what? Are you sure you don't want a MacBook? What are you saying? Mini? You have to call someone from the back. Do we have something called a Mac Mini?
Oh, God.
I mean, at least the Mac Pro, like, is probably next to the big TV, and they might have seen it. Oh, you mean that's a computer? All right. But anyway, it's... That's the worst part of this, is that regular people shouldn't have to care about this. They should have a reasonable expectation that they can go into an Apple store and sort of pick a computer based on how big they want it to be and how much they want it to cost, and have some basic understanding of, like, well, the more expensive ones are better and faster and fancier than less expensive ones, but not to have this massive gulf where it's like, I think I'm deciding between, do I want to have an integrated screen and an external screen? It's like, no, there are tremendous trade-offs between the 5K iMac and the Mac Mini that you really need to grasp before you make this decision. It's not as if they are just equivalent, but just the boxes are separate or together. And that's Apple's fault.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can kind of see, like, throughout the course of Apple's history, especially recent history, there are certain products that they keep around, like, out of spite, or I don't know. It's like certain products that they maybe spite's the wrong word, but, like, certain products where, like, they kind of begrudgingly keep them around, and you can tell they really don't like them. And it's almost like this tense relationship they seem to have with these products of just, like, disdain, and they just kind of, you know, crap out updates every so often because they have to. And, you know, it's the same way that, like this, you know, Steve Jobs famously demoing the Motorola Rocker phone, and you could tell he just, like, hated this device, and he was trying to put on a good face on stage, but he just hated it. To me, that is how Apple treats the Mac Mini, and possibly maybe even the Mac Pro these days. I don't know. Time will tell on that one. But the Mac Mini, certainly, that is how they treated it for a long time, where, like, they keep it updated because for whatever strategic reason or whatever, like they kind of have to keep offering this computer, which solves a bunch of needs, I guess. But they hate it so much, and they never let you forget they hate it. And every update, they like, we're going to give a little here, but then we're going to take away this other thing, and we're just going to make you hate this until you fools all stop buying it and you switch to one of our better computers. Like that is honestly the feeling I get about the Mac Mini, and I own one. And even when I bought it, I was mad about it, and I still bought it because I needed one. But it's like I was pricing it. I'm like, God, this thing is such a ripoff and so restricted, and so it's like it's just I felt all that anger that Apple clearly has for this product that they hate and they occasionally sell.
I wonder what the pressures are on the Mac Mini design. Like, is it like that every year the margins have to get better? Because that like that fits the data we have, kind of like that it does get more expensive and crappier, like relatively speaking. Obviously, it gets better when they, you know, with the exception of this recent quad to dual core transition. For the most part, it does get better. But like, it seems to me that the margins get better with every new version. And it's like they've kind of given up on, hey, we need to find a way to boost the sales of the Mac Mini because the sales are probably extremely low and not really going anywhere. But they said, but every year we can boost the margins by putting slightly cheaper stuff in it and removing the optical drive and, you know, doing all the stuff that we can do to, you know, like every group. Like you have to be measured on something. I know Apple famously has just a profit and loss line for the entire company and is not measuring every individual department, saying, well, Mac Mini team, what is your profit and loss for the year or whatever? But the products are changed with some kind of purpose, and increasing or at the very least maintaining margins seems to be a big Apple incentive. And when I look at what they're doing with the Mac Mini, what explanation for the evolution of that hardware and that product is there other than pressure to increase or maintain margins with each new revision, and not a lot of pressure to do anything with it until it's in desperate need of replacement, because it has never been a great bargain. But I feel like the value proposition has just gotten worse and worse. You were getting less for more money.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you said, Marco, if you need a tiny little headless Mac, this is your only option. And maybe that's just good business. Maybe Apple knows, hey, if people need a tiny little headless Mac, this is their only option. So just add, like, you know, a little tiny bit extra every year. Can we add, you know, take out 10 or 20 bucks worth of hardware and add 50 bucks to the price and do that every 3 years for the next 9 years? And pretty soon you have an $800 computer that's as fast as a pocket calculator.
Oh, goodness. What did you buy your Mac Mini for?
It's my iSCSI host, and it runs Backblaze to back up my Synology, and it's currently doing this live stream.
That's right.
It does a few, like, it's kind of where I put, like, utility software that I don't want junking up my main Mac. So the iSCSI driver was one of those things. I also use it as the Fujitsu ScanSnap software machine. Like, it runs the ScanSnap software. The ScanSnap scans to it, and then it just syncs things over via network sharing to my real computer. So it kind of does, like, this set of utility functions. It's kind of a home server in certain ways, but, you know, not always. You know, I don't know. I'm always looking for, like, possible plans of how I can rearrange my home setup such that I don't need it anymore. But it is still in use.
The correct answer to my question was a continuous integration server, but who am I kidding?
I know what that is, vaguely.
Here's the WWDC sessions about the testing bots.
Yes, it's one of those things where, like, when I see the session about it at WWDC, it looks and sounds really cool, but it also looks and sounds like it requires a lot of setup of testing and infrastructure that I don't probably want to set up. So someday that will sound really awesome to me. Someday when I have a staff of responsible programmers working for me, they can set that up, and I will just enjoy the benefits of it.
Yeah, we got to start small. We're starting with unit tests. We're not going to go all the way to continuous integration server. And for a single person shop, you probably don't need that, although Underscore probably has five of them. continuously building his software and running tests against them, and he has a little dashboard that sends him a message on his watch that tells him the state of all his applications as of the latest beta of the software.
And now he's really good at using time, so he probably didn't set that up.
No, he did, because now his applications write themselves. How do you think he writes all his app? He just, yep. You know, new betas of the OS come out. His little minions automatically download it, rebuild his software for it, click all the fix-it things in Xcode to fix all the problems that it finds, and then he has a little dashboard display on his watch while he's out for his evening constitutional that tells him how many of his apps have successfully upgraded for iOS 10 Beta 2, and, you know, one of them has one warning left, and he's going to go and sit down at his computer, click one button, he'll fix that one.
Job done.
So this is how I picture his life. Don't tell me if it's any different.
No, that's accurate. I've seen his setup. It's accurate.
All right. Thanks a lot to our sponsors this week, Eero, Wonder Capital, and Trunk Club. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
All right, so tell me about your potential new Accord, John, or the family's potential new Accord, anyway.
I mean, it makes sense. Like, Mike has two iPads, right?
I think he has 13.
That's right. So, you know, you can have two Accords.
Yeah, no, I don't have any problem with that. My wife's car is about 10 years old, and it's usually when we start thinking about replacing them, and it's pretty beat up. And she was thinking about what kind of car should she get, and she faces the same problems that you were talking about, Casey. She doesn't want an automatic transmission. Her options are really limited. We also don't want to spend a tremendous amount of money for the car for a variety of reasons. I mean, we know you just look at her old car and you just think of, you're going to buy a $60,000 car and it's going to look like that for 10 years, you're going to be sad. So we need, and you know, it needs to be reliable, big, be able to fit four people in it and all of our stuff, all that, you know, and we basically end up back in the same place we always end up, which is like the Mazda 6 or the Honda Accord. Those are the reasonably priced, reliable four-door sporty sedans you can get with the stick shift. And she resisted that for a while, started coming around a little bit when she was looking at the new Accord, started doing like the little builder thingy to build your own car. And I think what's pushing her over the edge is the fact that they have, once again, the same thing that they had when she got her current car. Her current car, she had I always get the model years wrong because I mess up with the calendar years, but a 2003 or 4-ish Accord that got totaled. And with we got a pretty good amount of money back from that. Basically, with the money from that car being totaled plus a little bit extra, we bought a 2006-ish Accord, and at that point it was the end of the generation, like the end of that, you know, that before they replaced it with the super ugly one that I never bought and never considered buying because it was terrible.
That was bad.
Yeah, that was like the worst Accord in a long time. Anyway, it was the end of the generation, and I guess they do this regularly. I don't know. I've only been buying Accords for, you know, 10 years or so I don't know. They make a special edition right at the end of the product line, so that for 2017 the Honda Accord Sport comes in a special edition, which is just the Honda Accord Sport, which, by the way, the Sport is, you know, we get the Sport because it has a stick shift. You can get the stick shift in the LX, but the Sport has like nicer wheels and stuff. But any of the cars with the stick shift, you can't get a lot of the nice options. So a lot of the fancy stuff that's in the V6 or in the high-end ones, you just can't get with a stick shift, which is a shame. So we're kind of like limiting ourselves. But the Sport Special Edition is still limited like the Sport, but has a few extra niceties. So it comes with leather seats and seat heaters, which she's wanted for a long time and we haven't been able to get because, for the most part, four-door stick shift sedans do not come with leather seats or seat heaters unless they're BMWs, like, you know, cheap cars. So finally, here is a car down in our price range with these fancy options in it. And it comes with the nice fancy wheels and all the little body treatments and all the other stuff that you want your Accord Sport to come with, and contrasting red stitching and a little ball shifter thing and all sorts of nice things there. Still doesn't come with navigation. You think you still can't get that. And the second thing that I think is attracting her to it is, for the most part, the Accord Sport comes in super boring colors. Like, you can get black, white, and gray. I think those are the only options when I bought my car. That's it. You know, Honda is not particularly magnanimous with the color choices.
That's not true. I'm looking at red right here, the Sport Special Edition, red.
Right. Well, so now red is an option, both in 2016, red is an option, and in the 2017 Special Edition. So she wants to get a red Honda Accord Sport Special Edition 2017 model.
These wheels are aggressive. I like them, but they're aggressive.
I know. Anyway, so this is probably the car she's going to get. And I think what is making her go over is the seat heaters. and the leather, which I don't think she's going to be that big of a fan of leather. I like cloth seats personally, but seat heaters, I think she will enjoy a lot. And the fact that she's going to get it in red. So she's bitten by the Marco red bug. She's at that stage in life where she wants to have a red car. Like, I would never buy this car. I would buy this in black immediately. But she can't tolerate having two black Accords, even though they would look as different as two of my children to me. To her, it's like looking at two penguins and they look exactly the same. You know, like, so 2017 and the 2014, they're totally different. The wheels alone, how can you not tell? Like, would I ever mistakenly get in the wrong car? It would never happen. But to her, she cannot have two black Accords, which is fine. It's her car. She can pick whatever color she wants. And really, her only options are white, black, gray, and red.
In other words, so black and red
is what we're going to be getting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't mind that. Like, I like the silver. The gray is really dark. But the silver, I think Accord does look good in silver. But silver is not an option for this.
So will this be better than your car?
Yeah, I mean, like, it obviously, seat heaters is going to make it better. And leather technically is better. But like I said, I think I like cloth better.
I mean, it looks like to me like it's better than your car in almost every way. Yeah. And how do you feel about that?
It's the same engine and transmission. And like I said, I don't think the leather seats are actually an improvement, especially, you know, I know the heaters are going to make them warm up in the wintertime, but it is cold initially unless you let the seats warm up before you get into the car. And I don't really like sitting on leather. I'd rather sit on cloth. But everything else about it, it's not faster, doesn't have a more powerful engine. I'm kind of jealous of her wheels because, like Casey said, they are more aggressive, and I feel like I should have the more aggressive wheels. But nah, it'll be fine. Like, I'm happy for her to have this car. If she likes it, then that's all I care about. I will continue to try to defend my car, even as my children scrape their bicycles against the side of it.
Why not a Zoom Zoom?
She doesn't seem that interested in that. And honestly, I am still a little bit wary of Mazda reliability. They're such a small company compared to Honda.
Aaron's car so far has been indestructible.
I know they're good. Like, we had a Mazda when I was a kid. They're fairly reliable, but I'm a little bit wary of that. I would still go with it if that's what she wanted. I think this Accord looks better than the 6. And honestly, we've just always been a Honda family. It seems silly to break the streak at this point. And the other practical concern is
that's a good reason to pick a car brand.
Well,
it seems silly to pick a different one.
Yeah. Well, we've been satisfied with Honda. Like, it's like going to the restaurant that you know you like rather than trying a different one. And the more practical reason is we like to take our cars to the dealer, which, whatever, it may be silly, but again, it's exchanging money for a peace of mind or someone to blame or whatever. And it's a lot easier to get to Honda dealerships from our house than it is to Mazda dealerships.
That's fair.
Whatever works. I was going to ask you something. Shoot. Somebody pointed out in the chat the same thing I was thinking. You know, I have no issue, quite obviously, with her getting a 6-speed. But if she had gotten an automatic, I think that would let her get a remote start. And in the barbaric conditions in which you live, that would probably be really nice, unless you would forego the garage and give her the garage spot.
I saw the remote start as an option in the little car builder thing. I didn't realize it probably had to be associated with the automatic. But it's not actually an automatic. It's a CVT is the other option. That's the Accord is so messed. Like, those are your options in Honda these days. You understand why I'm being chased down into this one little corner of Honda's car lineup. And eventually, like Casey, you know, I will be in a situation where this goes away. But in the meantime, I'm going to keep buying these. I really like my car. It's probably the best car I've owned. Possible exception of the 1992 Civic, which I really like, but was a death trap.
Yeah, you keep sticking with Honda. Let me know how that works.
Yeah, minor issues. No,
they are good cars. And this does look good.
Every car was a death trap in 1992. Come on, like, it was a tiny little economy car. Fair. We didn't have the technology to do this. Yeah, but the Accord is, this generation of Accord is a great generation. I don't know what the next generation will be like of Accord. So if you're thinking of getting a Accord and this is the last model year and they're going to switch it over in 2018. Get this car. Get a 2016. Get a 2017. The whole model line is just great.
God, I'm building my own 2017 Accord sedan, sport, special edition, 6-speed manual. That's the entire model name. Anyway, you're right. The exterior colors: black steel, which is gray; San Marino red, or white orchid, pearl white are your options. Your interior color: your choices are as follows: black leather. You have 3 choices of wheels, a bunch of really crappy exterior accessories, a handful of equally crappy interior accessories, and then electronic. Wait a second. The remote engine start is available.
That's what I said. Electronic
started
on there, but I think you're right. How can that be associated with the manual? How does that even work? Can't be.
Well, maybe if you leave it in neutral.
Yeah.
Which is not a good idea.
No, well, who does that? That's not how you park a car.
A lot of people do that. I agree with you. It's barbaric.
But if you don't do that and you hit the remote start, does your car lurch forward and slam into your garage wall? I mean,
yes, seriously. How can that be? That doesn't make
any sense. It's probably just their website not realizing, oh, you can't have that unless you have the CVT.
Yep, that's probably true.
And those stupid plastic accessories that you see, the exterior accessories, people buy those. I see them on the road all the time. Like, A, look at the prices, and B, look at what they look like. Some of them, I think, actually do look kind of cool. But
the body side molding looks good.
But usually people don't buy just one. They buy, like, all of them. And just look at the prices. Look at how much money they're paying.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
Anyway, I bring all this up to say that it is frustrating, not only how cheap this car is as compared to the sorts of cars that I am often pricing, which, again, I didn't buy my BMW new for that very reason, but there are so few actual options. Like, these are just, how do you say it, accoutrement or whatever? These are just...
Yeah, this is all dealer-installed crap.
Right,
that's what these things
exactly.
are.
But with BMW, they nickel and dime you over everything. It is absurd how bad they nickel and dime you over the dumbest crap. In fact, I don't think you even get leather for free.
Honda just added the floor mats like a couple years ago, I believe. Like, so I, for the first half of my Honda buying, you had to pay $150 for floor mats. They finally added that in. So that's a nice, break from the norm. But yeah, it's frustrating how few options are, because again, we would pay for navigation, we would pay whatever obscene price for navigation, because that's what my wife wants. She wants, even though we all know it's better on the phone and all this other stuff, she just wants to have a car with navigation to see what it's like.
Oh no, having it built in is awesome. I will tolerate like you know, even Tesla's system is okay, but it's not great. But I still use it instead of using my phone because it's built in, and having it built in is awesome.
Yep, I completely agree. And my maps are, well, I actually happen to have a BMW bill, repair bill, because that's what BMWs do, is they generate repair bills. I have one in front of me, which includes the delivery date, which was December of 2010. So I have maps from 2010. And every single time I get in the car when I don't know where I'm going, I will spend the time to plug it into the navigation, because it is so much more convenient and safe to look at the screen that's designed for that sort of thing than it is to be fumbling with my phone. And I could not agree more. Even an ancient car like mine is becoming, I would still rather have the onboard nav. So Tina is right to ask for it. I completely agree with
her. Yeah, but again, not an option. Like, so much, again, so, because this is basically the bottom of the line Honda, even though this is the special edition. And I wonder what other special edition things are. Like, her special edition had the faux carbon fiber trim. Like, that was the special edition. Her wheels, like, the things that distinguish her current Accord as special edition are, from the outside, is the wheels. And if you look inside, the fake carbon fiber that replaces, like, the trim bits. And that's basically it. And the people who, we got such a good deal on her car, the people who ordered this car before us and then backed out did add a couple of external bolt-on dealer accessories that I just had to, like, stomach, you know, like, I had, you know, because you can't really remove them because now there's, like, holes in the bodywork of where they mount them or whatever. So I had to just accept those. I don't particularly like them. I would never bought them myself, but this car was so cheap. We got such a good deal on this car. I assume we're not going to get that great of a deal on this 2017. The other 2017 thing I'm looking forward to is, supposedly they made their infotainment system software better, and there's a lot of room for it to get better, because it is so slow and so clunky and so Byzantine. It took me like 6 months to learn how to do the most basic things on it, and it still drives me nuts. So I'm happy for them to have, you know, they advertise it as, you know, being more responsive. They're like, please, anything, any improvement in that area that you can give me, I will accept. I'm sure they probably also made some other things worse. So anyway, I'm hopeful, vaguely hopeful about this car. But yeah, I'm slowly being chased out of the car market by stick shifts disappearing. And I'm being chased out of Hondas by Honda replacing all their transmissions with CVTs. Hopefully, by the time I'm really chased out of it, all the CVTs will have morphed into, you know, automated manual, you know, dual clutch transmissions, and that maybe I'll be able to tolerate more than the horror that is the CVT.
Yeah, DCT is livable. Like, if my future
it's
is
more
not
than livable.
If my future is not an electric car, then, and it's not a 6-speed, I will go out of my way to find a true DCT, because it is not the way I would prefer it, but it is certainly livable. Does this model year support CarPlay? Because you get the big screen, even if you don't get like a GPS chip, so to speak, right?
But it's not a touchscreen. It's just a display screen. So
well, CarPlay can use wheels and stuff too.
Right, right.
But there's no, well, there is kind of a wheel. It's not, it's not the, like the BMW system where you have like cursor control. It's not like that. It's more like a series of buttons. And sometimes the wheel scrolls, but that's it.
I mean, like, even like a D-pad kind of thing. Like, I'm pretty sure CarPlay works with all sorts of combination of these control schemes, you know, intentionally.
Honda does support CarPlay, so maybe it works, but really, it's not even a D-pad. It's not even a five-way thing. It is literally a cluster of buttons, one called menu, one called back, and then there's a button, and then there's a wheel, and the only thing the wheel does is move the selection up and down, but you're mostly hitting menu, back, and settings to try to navigate. And display, because some navigation options are not available unless a particular thing is displayed. So it is a terrible interface.
Yeah, when Marco and I and a couple of friends of ours went to Cupertino and Facebook when we were out in California, we rented a Mercedes GL45, which is a truly lovely SUV. Like, it's certainly not my kind of car, not the sort of thing I would want to drive, but darned if it wasn't really nice. That being said, I mean, iDrive has its problems. It's very opinionated, and it's a little bit weird, although I've come to absolutely love it, and iDrive is a BMW system.
iDrive is great.
Yeah, whatever they call the Mercedes system, it is unbelievably bad. I would assume this was like a $90,000 truck or something like that, or whatever it was. It was expensive. Maybe not $90,000, but it was expensive. And it was beautiful in so many ways. But this infotainment system was awful. Just unbelievably bad.
I'm guessing they probably just didn't give it a name out of mercy.
It's called Command, all caps. Yeah.
What?
They all have names.
God. I can't handle it. It was so unbelievably bad, just indescribably bad.
Yeah, there was a time about a year ago I was at a car rental place for on a trip, and I had to rent a four-door sedan, and there was a Mercedes E something or other that was available for a little bit more. I'm like, okay, sure, I'll do that. And it was a great pleasure to drive that car in many, many ways, but it had the same system, and my God, like, it's like using DOS. Like, it's like, what year is this, and how expensive is this car, and you have this system in here? Like, it's impressively bad.
Yep. If you go to automobiles.honda.com/accord-sedan, and if you scroll down, how did I get here? Of course, you can't link to anything on this stupid page. Ugh. If you scroll down, there's eventually a section where it says cockpit convenience or accessories. If you click accessories, then there's a button for Apple CarPlay where it says it is standard on EX, EXL, EXL, V6, and touring models, which I assume is not the sport model, which means no guts.
Yeah, it means no stick.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can get the stick in the LX, and we looked at that. Like, you can buy a non-sport one, and you get a few different options, but you get worse-looking wheels. And for me, that's the deal-breaker.
EX, EXL, and EXL V6, and touring. Those are your only options.
Yeah. The LX is the bottom of the bottom of the line. They got rid of DX. That's kind of a clever thing that Honda did in its naming. They used to have a letter system for like the trim levels, right? And DX was always the bottom. Like our Civic was a DX. That's why it only had one side mirror on it. Like, by design, right?
I still can't believe that was legal.
For a long time.
Yeah. That's a very tiny car. I think they basically retired the DX moniker because it became such a, like, you know, an anti-status symbol of like, oh, you got the super cheap one, right? And so now the bottom is just LX. All they did was shift the letters. Like, the LX is basically the DX. It's the same thing. Like, you know, no body-colored side mirrors. They don't do one mirror anymore, but it's really cheap. But yeah, the Sport is a step up from the LX. So even though you can get the LX, it's frustrating because you can get the LX with a stick, and you can get more options, a few more options on the LX, even though it is supposedly the lesser model, because the Sport is like, oh, you don't want those things. You want everything just to be sporty. It's like, no, well, you know, I would have taken the seat heaters in my car if they were an option, but they weren't an option.